Can I ask, from your perspective, there's a number of recommendations, Jared, that your seat has made. Which one out of all of them would you say we need to really focus on and invest more time in researching really pushing the discussion on?
Can I have two?
You can have two, of course.
So I do think the point around when you look at how we determine skills shortages and lists, it is a very difficult thing to understand. And I've read multiple things on the Department of Employment's website, and I get a different impression from reading, different documents around how they go about that process of providing advice. And then ultimately, the minister has the final call on the list. So there is a whole bunch of objective analysis that goes into it, but then that may not, what ultimately is decided may not reflect necessarily what's in that analysis. So I do think getting a lot more of that information out there, I think it allows business and others to have the debate around particular areas. And we've said in the report, even if we know that it's a resource intensive process. So even if you did that, every year, every 2 years, if you did it at some kind of on some kind of periodic basis, it would allow people to have those debates in a very informed manner, particularly around some of the areas of greatest contention. I think it would also, on the other side, help in terms of training, in terms of where we put our investment in education and training. So I think we can do both. We can make sure that we have a really good skilled migration program that's filling the areas that we need it to, but we can also be using that in terms of our information base for investment in education and training. So I know that transparency isn't necessarily in fashion, but that I think is the number one. I think then if I go to your point and the point that we've made in the report around the constant state of flux, and it's probably a very nerdy kind of policy point, but this idea of getting a regular evaluation from the Productivity Commission. And I think they are well equipped just on the basis that they are looking at other issues around the labour market, they're looking at issues around demography. So they've got that kind of broader picture of a whole bunch of policy areas that are actually really important in terms of the policy settings in this area. So they're the one plus one that I would choose.
Great, I agree. I actually agree with your comments, coupled with pathways to permanent residence on that list of occupations. Which ones do we need more long term, and having pathways? But I don't want to. I think I'll open to the floor now.
Take questions. My name's Paula. I'm from the Advertiser newspaper. One big issue I see, I was talking to someone from Streaky Bay this morning who they've just lost the only doctor in town and they had been trying to get two. So I guess the main thing is, how do you try to get people that are coming in with the skills to actually go to rural areas where there is a huge need for things like doctors?
I think it's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think one of the things that I think we had this conversation maybe in November here, where I talked about is it a kind of a chicken and egg situation in terms of thinking more broadly about economic development of rural and regional areas and attracting the capital, which then both attracts more labour, but then it also retains more labour and people in your area, because there is that level of economic activity that causes people to stay, and for people's partners to get jobs and all of those sorts of things. So I don't for a minute pretend that any of this is easy in terms of making sure that we keep appropriately skilled people in areas where they're really needed, but I don't think you can do that without having a broader kind of plan in terms of economic development and having very kind of influential local players who want to make that happen, including investors. So where I'm from, originally from in Toowoomba in Queensland, I think when I lived there, the population was about 80,000. It's now 160,000. There's been a couple of, you know, long-time families in that region who have made major investments that have opened that town to the world. So as I look at these kind of different stories of economic development of regions, I think it's hard to kind of focus in on one part of the story. I do think you have to take a pretty comprehensive approach.
Andrew Parkin, Flinders University. Thanks, Jared, for that very erudite presentation. You presented a reassuring figure of an average, I think, salary of 95,000.
Yep.
A reassuring figure in terms of not undercutting wages and bringing in sort of a underclass of low-paid workers. Before I proceed, my question, is that an average across the skilled category or the whole temporary migration category?
Yep. It's an average across the skilled category. I think the other point to point out is, and I say this as an economist, I would have preferred to have presented the median, which is a better, obviously, you're going to have a lot of people in, you know, as I was talking about, for example, global talented executives and whatever, you will have people who are on incredibly high salaries, you would expect. But the average is what's published. So I've had to use the
okay,
average.
It'd be more reassuring if we had a figure about the 100% of the temporary rather than the 10% you're talking about. And given a lot of them are students and working holiday makers, I'd posit the average would be rather lower. So the impact on wages around the country would be very considerably lower. Do you have a figure for the average wage for the 100% of temporary migrants rather than the 10%?
Yeah. No, we don't. And this is an area that we are following up on. We're trying to get more data, and it is an area that requires absolutely more information for precisely the reason that you're asking.
So in terms of reassurance,
question,
it'd be nice to know the other 90%.
Yeah.
Because it's a crucial question.
Yep, absolutely.
And we have 90% we don't know. All right, how confident are you that the data on the 10% you do know is accurate, given that the scandals we read about are people, in fact, not being paid the wage that they are supposed to be paid? They are being underpaid. So is the average of what the registered salary is supposed to be, or is the average of what the actual in-pocket wage actually is for chefs and whatever, engineers and mining executives and Chinese workers in the Pilbara and whatever?
It's the average base salary, so it's what went into the application that the Department of Home Affairs has. And again, that's the data that's
so we infer
available.
In fact it's lower because the evidence we have from the scandals is of chronic underpayment in some of those areas. I mean, the celebrated case in Melbourne of the chef who's been underpaying workers for a long time. That's all. So there are two important deficiencies in the data.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Having said that, certainly we absolutely support the Migrant Workers Task Force and the recommendations that they have put forward. And as we say, this is not underpayment, particularly in those areas where those visa categories where it has been rife. Is obviously an issue and needs to be addressed.
Hey, how you going? Mark Glasbrook. Just picking up on that point, the Immigration Department does data match or share information. So the Immigration Department are aware of the salaries that are being paid to applicants or that's nominated in the visa application, and that can be checked with the ATO. The department also have a pretty stringent monitoring program to ensure that there's compliance within the temporary 482 visa program, which is great, but there still is a lot of exploitation that needs to be cleaned up to maintain the integrity of the overall program.
Mark, can I ask you, while because you work in this space, what would you say the number one or two key changes that need to be focused on, I guess, in this space, from your perspective?
In terms of increasing integrity or just making sure the operational structure of the migration program
works? I think we do need to, personally, increase integrity, but more about the operational space.
Operational space, probably get rid of the program completely and start again. Focus on a demand-driven program rather than human accumulation. Human accumulation, people get a visa, they can live and work wherever they want. So if we're trying to design a program that's going to address the future workforce needs of the country or a state, how do we do that? Giving visas to people that have got no intention to live and work in a regional area in a certain occupation doesn't really benefit anyone. Those people make their way to the bigger cities, adding to stress on congestion and population growth, whereas we need people to move to our region. So getting people to move to Streaky Bay as a doctor, if the migration program's not working and not delivering those outcomes, then obviously it's not working. So get rid of that program and start with something that is demand-driven and can deliver the outcomes that we need. When you have a look at the federal government, should they be delivering or doing research on skill shortages, or should that be done by the states? The states are designing training programs to address the future workforce needs, then why can't the state be doing the research on what we need in terms of a migrant workforce to fill that gap up until the time that the training program can deliver the people that we need? So I'd probably start there and maybe move to the Secretary of the Immigration Department and get someone in that's going to align the program to the genuine needs of the economy.
Okay, thank you. There's a question here also.
Stephen Simons from Oricon. I'm just going to change tack.
Yeah.
My question's around mega infrastructure projects, and we work in that field. And we're also hearing that moving forwards, you know, we need to keep pumping these out so that governments are happy we're pushing them out. These projects are getting bigger and bigger. Some of them now $16 billion. Mm-hmm. Which means that not only constructors, but designers, et cetera, have to joint venture on these projects. So it's a question around speed to market and ability to deliver these things. And I'm just wondering your view on, are we progressing around the temporary to permanent programs to be able to actually resource these projects up, to be able to deliver them, and just your view on, are we making progress on this? Because the need to actually joint venture to get them delivered, governments are saying we're doing the right thing, we're keeping the economy ticking over, but it is getting tougher and tougher to get the right skills in place in time. Just wonder if you have a view on that, and are we progressing?
So I can give my view, and Chris might have a view as well. So I think in the mining boom, there are a lot of labour agreements, and same issue in terms of getting people in. I don't understand, particularly when a lot of the investment is being driven from public sources, that we're not thinking about this in a much more systematic way and undertaking the workforce planning and understanding in what years, in what states, in what cities we will need particular people. And we always seem to be behind the curve. And we know that our economy is like this, and in some cases, as I said, it's public infrastructure, so it's being driven by the government. So, but I think there's both an industry, industries need to band together on this stuff and present that information, and there's probably a role for better coordination between governments, I think, as well. Certainly in recent conversations that I've been in between Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, there was almost like a bunch of projects were coming on in Queensland, you know, 2 years after Victoria and New South Wales had really ramped up their projects, and they're like, oh, that's good, you know, we timed that well. And it was almost like we timed it well by accident, not we actually did think about that and take it into account. I think there's a lot to be done. Yeah. The other thing that I worry about is when resources picks up again, and we see a lot more projects coming online. You know, just how prepared are we for that next phase? Particularly, and we point out in the report the number of mining engineering graduates and has really dropped off post the boom. So that's an area that we should be thinking about now. How are we going to scale up and equip ourselves next time?
I mean, the input outcome is the project's getting pushed offshore. So it doesn't
yeah.
just
yep.
And that's the input outcome. I just find that illogical. So
hence
the question.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think, heavily represent clients in this space, and we're way behind and not responding quick enough. I mean, try find a railway engineer these days or site or project managers. And the visa, no matter what, how many times we bring this issue to the department or government's attention, they still want to fit us within the current framework, so and not thinking more in this particular time, how can we assist with the different visa options, for example, to get speed on ground. The 400 visa isn't particularly, which is short-term work, allows for someone to come in for up to 6 months, and then that's it. But these projects are going way over. And then we've had to cycle, relodge, try and find someone else on a project from somewhere else for another 3 months. So it's really challenging at the moment. Any other questions?
Yeah. Hi, Shelley Stroke from Department for Innovation and Skills. On a similar track of workforce planning, you made mention of the ANSCO, and I think a lot of people would welcome a review of that sooner rather than later. But I'm really interested in your thoughts on how you think the ANSCO being slightly outdated and matching industry needs and trends, what impact that has on planning in terms of skilled migration largely, as well as economic development, if we don't have a list that visas are reliant on to bring people in either short-term or long-term, what impact that has when people are coming on with an ANSCO code that doesn't really match an industry need and where they end up working.
Yeah, sure. I can start, and I think Chris will have plenty of experience on kind of specific cases in dealing with this. The only kind of explanation that's given to me around why this review hasn't taken place to date is around funding, which seems to be the case a lot at the moment, particularly federally with certain initiatives, which I think is disappointing. I think it has a huge impact, not just in this area, but this is something that we need to rely on across our economy in terms of, as I said, also thinking about it in terms of education and training and other things that need to happen. I don't think the system will ever be perfect because it is a classification system. It's not going to be able to react, you know, day to day, week to week, month to month as jobs change. But I do think that you end up with, you know, so industries will present cases of a shortage in a particular occupation that may reflect a lot more than one occupation. Under the code, they need to present that, but it may be a multitude of skills and a multitude of skills in different places depending on where that role is, the particular weighting on different skills. So when I think about future labour markets and planning and thinking about jobs that, that don't currently exist. I think as a baseline, we absolutely have to review this thing. And we also have to have a little bit of a think about how do we, you know, is this going to only accelerate and so it's going to become out of date quicker and quicker, and therefore do we need to, you know, does the system need to change? Is reviewing it more regularly sufficient? How do we address that? And I think it is a big, certainly most businesses that I speak to, it's a big question for them, particularly when they talk about how they're designing jobs and roles now, that it's not according to that sort of mindset and system.
I agree. We see a particular issue with a recent example is a data scientist. How do you fit that in a occupation that's on the list, but clearly so niche and specialised? The Department of Home Affairs has tried through this global talent scheme to say, well, allow business to put forward occupations that are not on the list or don't fit neatly on the list. But the policy, I guess, guidelines may prevent some businesses from actually using that program. As an example, you have to be an accredited business sponsor, or you have to be, the position needs to be paid more than $145,000. So that might be limiting, because in some circumstances, there are occupations that are highly specialised but are not being paid, you know, new and emerging occupations, but they're not being paid that high level at this point in time. So it is tricky, and the problem with reviewing the lists or occupations regularly is, again, it creates uncertainty in that what goes on the list, what comes off the list, can business plan, or can a visa applicant or an employee plan their future when it's so uncertain whether or not, you know, they will, there's a pathway, example, to permanent residence to staying there. So it's tricky. But certainly I think, and that's what we were saying before, the number one priority and focus should be on that, on the ANSCO and list reviews.
Interesting.
Mark,
I actually don't think there's anything wrong with the ANSCO. Okay. It's the way that it's used by the department that's the problem.
Yeah.
The ANSCO is a statistical tool which is designed through census data. So through the census, people report on what occupations they're working in, and then that's coded onto the ANSCO. There's a whole range of occupations that don't have enough people working in them, or jobs. If there's not enough people working in a job, then that job won't be added to the ANSCO. But they're classified under the not elsewhere classified occupations, but the department have removed most of those occupations off the list. So you don't have the flexibility that you should have to nominate those occupations. So the ANSCO is actually not too bad. An example of how poorly the department used the ANSCO and how it doesn't align is an occupation like production horticulturalist. You can study a Cert 3, Cert 4 and a diploma of production horticulture. It's approved under the training.gov.au website, so you can go there, you can see it, but there's no role of production horticulturalist on the ANSCO. So there's a difference between sort of proactive courses and more historical data, which is reflected in the ANSCO. But I don't think you can ever change that, because, you know, if you're waiting every 4 years for the review of the outcome of the census, then you're not going to get that contemporary sort of reflection of new occupations on the ANSCO. But if you have a look at the way that the ANSCO is structured, skill level 1, 2, 3, 4, skill level 1 is a degree level occupation. So if you have an occupation rather than going to the global talent scheme, which is very poorly designed, if you can have more flexibility in the use of the 482 program by having access to not elsewhere classified titles, then it would address that concern. But yeah, I just wanted to know. Excellent research, great presentation. I think, though, the ANSCO is okay. It's just the way that it's used by the department, which is the challenge.
Any other questions from the audience? Can I ask about maybe what you're seeing for with the whether the labour market testing requirement is maybe question to you, Jared. Do you think from your research, achieving what it's supposed to be achieving?
Well, most of the business feedback that I've had has been around the fact that the requirement is so prescriptive that you end up kind of almost organising your process around having to do that in your timelines, which doesn't seem to be the right way around. I think also areas where the industry, where it is common agreement that it's an area in shortage, and also in particular regions where there's consensus, yet we still go through this process. And especially, I think, as well, and this goes to the kind of point around more information on the data and analytics and how this process is put together, we now have the ability with machine learning and everything else to scrape job websites and understand what is going on in the labour market with an incredible level of data. So I think we should be thinking in the first case around, are there some things that we can do to make it less prescriptive? And secondly, with technological advances and data, are there more efficient and also, frankly, more reliable ways because of the level of data that you can collect to essentially meet the same objective?
We see that particularly the current requirement of providing evidence of testing the local labour market within 4 months of the nomination application being lodged is particularly tricky because the process now takes so long that by the time, in terms of obtaining police clearance certificates and all the rest, that by the time you actually get it lodged, that 4 months could have ran out. It takes longer pre-lodgement to prepare an application and get it to lodgement. And so now we have to track the advertising and when that ends. So having maybe 6 months might be easier. Previously it was, up to 9 months, but from a practical perspective, that would help. But I also see other countries like Singapore, for example, and this was mentioned in your report. In Singapore, everyone needs to advertise on the government's job website and places an ad for 2 months, for 2 weeks, and all they have to refer is to the job code, and everyone knows it's up there, and then that's all that is required in terms of the testing the local market. And it just, for temporary visas, all that data is available to government to actually check where the shortages are. And we find in Singapore in particular, the system works quite well in terms of that evidentiary requirement.
If there's no more questions, we'll perhaps finish the formal part of it. I know Chris and Jared are here for a little while longer. We do have a lot of morning tea still left. But perhaps if you could just join with me